Good morning, everybody. Let's get started. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And the first order of business is approval of the minutes of April 4th. Representative Bierman.
I'd like to move the minutes of April 4th, Madam Chair.
All right. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of April 4th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. So, folks, today we have a somewhat aggressive agenda, and we do have a floor session at noon, so we really need to move pretty expeditiously. So I think all of the testifiers have been put on notice. We can give them only 2 minutes. We're going to have to be quite strict in enforcing that so that we can move through our agenda today and get to the floor. So sometimes we have a little wiggle room. Today we don't. So the first bill on the agenda is House File 4757, Chair Stevenson. So I will move that House File 4757, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the General Register. And there is an author's amendment. The A13, Representative Stevenson, did you want to have that on the bill to discuss it?
Yes, Madam Chair. It gets the bill in the shape. I'd like the committee to consider it.
All right. So I will move the A13 amendment. And so let's adopt that. And then Chair Stevenson will describe the bill as amended. So all in favor of adoption of the A13 author's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Chair Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 4757 is the cannabis policy bill. It is primarily the agency bill produced by the Office of Cannabis Management, but it contains a handful of member provisions as well. A good deal of the bill is not in the jurisdiction of this committee. I'm going to try and focus in my opening remarks on the items that are. Probably the most significant item in the bill is an accelerated timetable for the transfer of the Office of Medical Cannabis, OMC, to the Office of Cannabis Management, OCM, so moving OMC out of the Department of Health into OCM. That was already contemplated by last year's bill. We're going to move it up more quickly to allow OCM to get to work working with the medical companies. There's also some changes to the medical program, including Representative Herr's bill to allow doctors to recommend cannabis for treatments beyond the statutory list. There's also additions to the statutory list, which is important for veterans and other groups. There's also some changes to the registered caregiver program, including a proposal to allow patients to designate their registered caregiver as the person who can grow their plants for them. So those are a few of the changes. There are more. Happy to answer questions. I know there are testifiers. I'll leave it there. It's light.
All right. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So the first testifier on the list is Max Zappia. If you'd please come down. And after that, we have Amber Shimpa, Kayla Fearing, and Marin Schroeder. So if you could kind of all be ready, knowing the order that you're in, be ready to come down and so we can move expeditiously. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be in front of you all. For the record, my name is Max Zappia. I serve as the Chief Regulatory Officer for the Office of Cannabis Management. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to join Representative Stevenson to present our proposals to the committee. At the Office of Cannabis Management, we are tasked with standing up the new agency and developing the operational and regulatory framework to oversee the cannabis industry in Minnesota. We are focused on a successful launch of a safe, effective, and sustainable adult-use market while maintaining safe, reliable access to products for registered medical cannabis patients. These proposals in front of you are part of the agency's recommendations to support this mission. The goal of our legislative recommendations is to strengthen the underlying foundation of Chapter 342 and to build upon the intent of last year's legislation as developed together by legislators and advocates. As part of our office's work, we are planning for the transfer of the current hemp-derived enforcement team housed to the Department of Health and the transfer of the entire Office of Medical Cannabis and Medical Program. These transitions are already contemplated in Chapter 342, and our recommendation to accelerate the timing is based in desire to allow earlier integration of staff, support consistency in enforcement, and build continuity in operations and access for medical patients. Additionally, we recommend modifications to the medical program in order to support patients and their caregivers. We propose removing undue financial burdens for caregivers, lifting limits on patients' access to purchasing products, and introducing new ways for patients to access products at more locations. Thank you for your time. I stand ready with Representative Stevenson to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Amber Shimpa? Amber Shimpa maybe isn't here. Okay. All right, let's go on to Kayla Fearing.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Hello. Good morning, Chair Liebling and Health and Finance and Policy Committee. Special thank you to Rep. Andy Smith for co-authoring the bill I will be mentioning in my statement. My name is Kayla Fearing. I'm here speaking on behalf of Healing Fear Consulting, the Minnesota Craft Home Growers Cannabis Community, and medical cannabis patients. I'm here to show support for HF 4757 and thank Rep. Stevenson for including a defined designated caregiver program originally presented as HF 3766 in Section 30 of this bill. However, caregivers and patients have continued to express concerns since inclusion. As a community, we believe that the wording of one patient is challenging. We're hoping that this legislation would open up this proposal to at least three patients for a designated caregiver to best fit the medical needs of Minnesotans that use cannabis as their preferred medicine. Allowing for two or more patients would create a clearer incentive for craft home growers to continue to grow and provide medical-grade cannabis for patients that are not themselves, especially given the uncertainty of the medical cannabis market and program and this proposal brought forward by the Office of Cannabis Management. For examples, allowing for multiple patients, three to be exact, per designated caregiver would truly benefit Minnesotans who are in multi-generational homes, group home settings, or religious settings. All of these subcultures mentioned have patients and craft cannabis home growers within them that would benefit tremendously from HF 4757 being amended from one patient to three patients. During this process, I have received over 40 statements personally from members of the public, all in my hands here. Almost all of these statements have expressed concerns over being able to continue growing medicine for loved ones. Examples were adult children growing for elderly parents and a living grandparent, a single father previously who is now growing for three adult daughters who are pre-diagnosed to breast and ovarian cancers, or a brother who has now been growing for his wife, his sister-in-law, and brother. Minnesotans who have all green thumbs choosing with no legal protection currently to grow medical-grade cannabis for their loved ones, regardless of the law. Thank you for your consideration of this amendment to appease caregivers and patients.
Thank you for your testimony. Maren Schroeder, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Liebling, Representative Stevenson, and members of the committee. My name is Maren Schroeder, and I'm speaking today on behalf of Sensible Change Minnesota, a patient and consumer-led advocacy nonprofit that has been advocating for patients since 2019. Through my work with this organization, I also served in the unique role as Coalition Director for Minnesota is Ready, where I spent hundreds of hours meeting with stakeholders and subject matter experts to develop policy recommendations. One of the areas of particular interest to me during that last year's process was expanding access to medical cannabis patients through incentivizing small and mid-sized businesses to participate in the market, which we did. Unfortunately, the proposal from OCM seeks to undo that incentive without an answer to how will we grow the medical cannabis market and ensure patients have access throughout the state. There is a huge risk in leaving the medical cannabis market to the medical cannabis combination license, which is the only license type incentivized to participate in the program under this proposal. It pits patients against those small and mid-sized businesses we attempted to leverage to improve patient access through the process of developing Chapter 342. Despite other changes proposed, like unification of supply chain and creating the medical cannabis consultant role that would benefit patients if businesses had incentive to serve this market. With this proposal, there is also no guarantee that the two medical companies serving patients today will get a license. With the removal of the merit system and incentive for the market to serve medical cannabis patients, it is my belief that patients will continue to have limited access despite our best efforts to advocate for the past decade to ensure patients are heard, even if some days it feels like it's for naught. We look forward to continued discussions with policymakers to ensure patient needs are not lost in this process. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there, that concludes the list of testifiers that I have. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill?
I think she,
oh,
she arrived.
Okay, Amber, why don't you come on down? We're moving faster than usual today. So, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Amber Shimpa, and I'm the CEO of Vireo Health of Minnesota, one of the two medical cannabis operators in the state. I was personally present on July 1st of 2015 when Vireo served Minnesota's first medical cannabis patients. And for the past 9 years, it's been an honor to lead our team while serving more than 55,000 Minnesotans with compassionate care. I'm proud of the way we have supported my home state with our community partners. We have advanced medical research and supported expungement and clemency efforts. And we have a 9-year track record of providing jobs for hundreds of Minnesotans and supported labor peace under a CBA with the local 1189 UFCW. We applaud the work that went into crafting last year's adult use bill and into laying the initial groundwork for the launch of adult use sales. The bill contained many common sense outcomes, such as streamlining efforts to expunge nonviolent cannabis charges, generous home grow and possession limits, and the creation of the medical combination license, which allows up to 90,000 square feet of cultivation capacity. Achieving a successful rollout of adult use programs is a challenging undertaking, and we have seen programs fail when the process pits applicants and stakeholders against each other. Our shared responsibility as stewards of cannabis in Minnesota is to be stronger together. This isn't a zero-sum game or winner-take-all. A successful industry depends upon folks both competing and working together to have a robust supply chain. This supports good business, good product safety, and brings consumers to the regulated and taxed market. The demand for cannabis in Minnesota will be large enough to enable success at every level of the supply chain. But a minimally viable market launch with a slower tiered issuance of licenses and an insufficient dual supply chain will put a successful program implementation at risk. Establishing licensing timelines for all license types now will provide all applicants with the visibility needed to ensure success in the market. Unfortunately, last year's bill lacks a clear path to ensuring continuity for access to medical patients. For some patients, medical cannabis is a vital component of managing symptoms and living a fulfilling life. A responsible rollout must ensure that medical patients can continue accessing the products they rely on. Standalone medical in an emerging adult use market is not a viable business, and the continuity of medical program goes hand in hand with the licensing of the medical combination license.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
Yes, thank you. Minnesotans deserve to have choices in their cannabis industry, and a responsible, common sense rollout that fully utilizes all available supply can and should be part of this program's implementation. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. So we'll close the testimony and go to member discussion. So Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson. My question is on your amendment, page 6, lines 6.1 to 6.5, there is language being deleted about a background check for a designated caregiver. And I'm wondering if you can just talk to us for a minute. What was the intent of including that language to begin with, and why are we deleting that language now?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, I believe that that original language probably predates House File 100 and goes back to the start of the medical program. I look back at Mr. Johnson to verify that. So I can't really speak to why it was in there originally. And I might ask Mr. Zappia to come up and talk about why the office proposes removing that section.
Yeah, come on up.
Sorry, Chair, I realize I may have jumped the gun on that one. Chair Liebling, thank you for the question. This is a recommendation that's based on a lot of feedback we've gotten from patients and caregivers. What we found is this kind of requirement poses a financial burden every 2 years and is not similar to other caregiver requirements that we see around state programs.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it a timing issue that the two-year renewal requirement is more often than is required for other caregivers? Because what I'm reading is that they're eliminating the background check altogether. Should we just be aligning that with other caregivers instead of eliminating it altogether?
And Representative Brindley, could you repeat what lines you were
focusing on? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Line 6.1 to 6.5, it completely removes the required background check for designated caregivers. And so, again, my question would be, if it's a question of alignment, perhaps that would need to be shifted, but it seems like we're removing the background check altogether here.
Mr. Zappia?
Chair, Representative, I correct, this would remove the requirement. And again, this is based on feedback from caregivers who are finding this financially burdensome. And my understanding is many of the similar caregiver roles do not require a background check either. Or comparable, I should say.
Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope, Representative Stevenson, we can maybe look at that moving forward to make sure that it is aligned, because certainly, I mean, I my curiosity was actually, you know, I wondered if there was some difference here, if a disqualifying felony offense would be related to House File 1, because obviously there are being great strides made to ensure that people are not disqualified for certain felonies, which is the intent of the bill, and that would make sense. But if this, and so I asked because this is very specifically related to caregivers, and so certainly that piece of it we should make sure is indeed in alignment with our requirements for caregivers more broadly, because that would relate to felony offenses unrelated to marijuana convictions in the past.
So, Representative Brindley, I think I understand where you're going here, and my understanding is that this is really separate from any background requirements for caregivers under DHS and under other kinds of licenses, and maybe we could get nonpartisan staff to kind of speak to that. What is a caregiver under this particular statute? Because I think we're not talking about the same kind of thing. I mean, my understanding is these are like family caregivers and things like that. So I don't know, who could speak to that? Is that Mr. Johnson maybe? Or Ms. Clarkfist.
Madam Chair and members, I can just say for the medical cannabis program, a registered designated caregiver is somebody with authority to obtain medical cannabis for the patient. That's kind of their caregiving role in this program.
Yeah, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the point still stands then. Maybe that should be looked at a little bit more closely to make sure that there are not other disqualifying offenses that we should be considering and thinking about. And my only other question, comment, I've made it before. I'll just say it again. You know, I mean, I actually appreciate the inclusion of Representative Herr's language that the determination will be based on a physician's recommendation. That probably makes more sense than probably should have been the case from the beginning. You know, I mean, I pointed out that when the original medical cannabis bill was passed, I did a lot of digging. I was not a member of the legislature at the time. I did a lot of digging, talked to a legislative director to find out why was Crohn's disease included? Because, you know, one of the largest GI practices in the state came to me and said, why in the world is Crohn's on this list? We're never going to prescribe this. It doesn't make any sense. And after quite a bit of digging, it came down to a patient with Crohn's testified that it would be helpful to them. And now it's law, right? Like, this is how we make the sausage around here. And, you know, I mean, I was at a conference for ALS and asked the physicians, you know, what's the efficacy for marijuana? Well, there is none. It makes no sense for ALS. And I would add, and now, you know, we're adding we're adding autism spectrum disorder and OCD to this list. And I've got real concerns. You know, by putting this in law, there is an implication that this is the solution for folks. And that is dangerous. Having a son who both has autism spectrum and has been treated for pretty severe OCD adjacent to that autism spectrum disorder, this is really, really concerning to me that as lawmakers, we are choosing to put this in law rather than leaving this in the hands of physicians, which is really where it should be. And again, the point being that when we put it in statute, there is an implication that we know, that this is a good idea, that this is going to make a difference for you and help you. And we as lawmakers shouldn't be making that decision. And I made that point in the beginning when we heard Representative Hurd's bill. That really is the answer. Leave it to physicians when we are doing this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative New Brindley, I agree with you that it would be ideal if we could just delete the list and have just, if your doctor recommends it. The issue is the interplay with the federal government and particularly with veterans. So people who are accessing their care through the VA don't have the option necessarily of using that sort of catch-all route. They need the list in order to have access to cannabis, and that's why it's important to keep the list of conditions even after adding the provision with the doctor. And I did just want to add on the registered caregiver. Members should keep in mind that when we passed the medical cannabis bill, it was the most restrictive medical cannabis program in the country. And so things like having a registered caregiver, someone who's literally just responsible for picking up your cannabis and delivering it to you, required some pretty strict controls that I think most of us probably looking at now would say that doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly in an age where now it will be legal to buy cannabis, legal to give it to another person. Do we need a background check for someone to do something that is lawful for anyone to do? I'm not convinced of that. So just keep in mind that the context of when this program was passed, it was very restrictive. And now we are in a different world where we have legalized cannabis in Minnesota.
All right. Thank you. Representative Plum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I remember the floor debate on the original medical cannabis bill. And one of the key debates and issues was quality control. There are dozens of cannabinoids that are there and the different variations of marijuana, hemp, however you want to, people who reference it. And some of the other less known cannabinoids have different impacts or major impacts on how well it may assist different medical conditions. In discussions with a researcher and developer for drugs for rare diseases, we got into that there's so many variations and the second and third order effects from the different cannabinoids. And in fact, what's in the soil that you're growing it has an effect. And they were developing things for specifically a few rare diseases, and they saw a huge difference. And so they've got a hydroponic setup and extreme control in order to verify that it's repeatable and it isn't going to vary. But if we're moving it out of a medical cannabis group or organization, the farther we get from people that have their background in medicine and inherently through training and years of interaction, know the right things to, hey, what about this and that, to establish good control and not let something change that loses consistency dose to dose. I have some unease with that. If it's medical, then we should have it connected to entities and personnel that are medically trained, familiar with both, federal and, state medical practices and that. Just the medical record privacy, you're in an organization that you've got it entrained in you so that you're always careful about the privacy and different aspects. You go to an entity that doesn't have that inherent training, and not all people have been familiar with that. So that's my ill at ease, is because medical requires a great deal of control and second, third order thought. I don't see this progressing to being more safety for medical, and try and make me feel comfortable.
So, I'm going to thank you for that, Representative Quam. So I'm going to go to Representative Nadeau, and then I'm going to ask Representative Stevenson to make his closing comments, and then he can, wrap up with that, I think. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two things, Representative Stevenson. So on the amendment, line 10.1 to 10.3, it's a patient shall receive only medical cannabis from a registered manufacturer or tribal medical cannabis program, but it's not required to receive medical cannabis from those places. Can you explain to me what that means? It's line 10.1 to 10.3.
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative, so this is existing law that you're looking at, and we're saying that a patient can receive, so Representative Nadeau, this is under the old medical program that was created, a decade ago, and so it did restrict where you could purchase medical products from. The reference to tribal medical cannabis programs is new. We added that last year. This entire section of law, Chapter 15230, will be repealed once OCM establishes the new medical program. So the limit, if I'm gathering your question, is of why are we restricted to these people, it's because under the old system, you could only buy from the registered medical cannabis companies. Obviously, that will change, and when it does change, that section of law gets repealed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Doe, I actually noticed the very same thing you're asking about.
Yeah.
And maybe, I don't know, Ms. Clarkvist, is this something you could comment on? It does look like it's just a strange sentence that seems to contradict itself. Could you comment on that?
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, in the Health Department's medical cannabis program, the two terms used are medical cannabis, and that refers to all the substances that you ingest, and then medical cannabis products are the delivery devices. So this sentence says that you have to purchase medical cannabis, the cannabis product, from a registered manufacturer or a tribal program, but you can purchase the ancillary products from other locations.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Does that help, Representative Nadeau?
It does, and I just have one short follow-up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. And so back to what Representative New Brindley was talking about, this is we do have some reference. Registered designated caregivers is not very well defined in statute, but it is in 144.65.22. It's a lower level, but the thing that I'm concerned with in this, and hopefully you can work on it, is that if these caregivers, they're going to have access to money, they're going to have access to products, and when that happens, if we remove the background check, it's problematic. In most contracts that we have with, well, in this case, I'm going to use the example of disabled people or direct service providers. Those providers are required to not only have insurance coverage, but also have employee dishonesty coverage because they're handling people's assets and money. So I am really concerned that we're removing that background check. And I know that in statute, under that one, under the 144.65.22, there is not a background check required under that statute where it specifically designate that caregiver. But in this case, because I think it's a little bit expansive, it's expanding on what that definition is. I would recommend that I understand that it might be problematic, but they do have access to people's resources, and that would be an odd carve out in our current background check laws. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Nadeau. So Chair Stevenson, do you want to do some short closing?
Just really briefly, the note that Representative Quam's concerns about the medical professionals' involvement. I just note the latter sections of the bill transfer all of the employees from the Office of Medical Cannabis over to OCM. So all the people with that expertise that he's concerned about will be moving over to OCM and able to provide that guidance. I appreciate the committee's time.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4757, the first engrossment as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The bill is on its way. Thank you very much. Okay. Next, we are going to take up a bill that is officially my bill, House File 5317. I'm just going to stay here because, oh, sorry, Representative Herr, we'll get to you hopefully soon. And this is the governor's budget. So do we have folks who are going to come and present the budget? Come on up, whoever's planning to present their budget. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm just pulling it up.
And so I should officially move the budget bill. So House File, I'm going to move that House File 5317 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Oh, it worked. Great. Okay, Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the budget director of the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to present a few items in the governor's budget in the bill before you. Starting off, we'd just like to kind of center ourselves around what we're here for and the role that our agency plays in the state. Our mission is to provide, to work with many others across the state to assist people to meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. This next slide just kind of goes over the magnitude of the impact of our agency. We serve 48% of kids across the state, 27% of adults, 17% of older adults, and 37% of people with disabilities. So this slide just kind of goes over the magnitude of transformative investments, thanks to everything you did last session, centered around making the experience of Minnesotans better over time. We serve over 1.5 million Minnesota residents, and you made a lot of investments in the area of behavioral health services, health insurance coverage, particularly for kids. And our agency is in the middle of implementing all those wonderful things as well as organizing ourselves into three different agencies. So going into the details of some proposals in the bill before you, we have a public option implementation plan. So in your bill last year, you appropriated some funding for DHS, the Department of Commerce, and MNCHR to work together on analysis and planning around implementing a public option. What we're coming forward this year is a continuation of that project and specific activities that we really need to do to prepare the state for applying for a 1332 waiver. So this includes community engagement activities to really work with people who need health insurance coverage or who have experience on the public health care programs to really identify eligibility and improve enrollment processes and systems that would result in a positive rollout and a meaningful program if we implemented this. The investment also includes development of an informational technology solutions project around if we implemented a public option, we would really need to identify how we would systematically do that in our IT infrastructure. So this investment is really key in implementing that. The investment also includes additional actuarial work to identify the programmatic costs and to support regulatory consultation needed that the Department of Commerce would need in order to submit the 1332 waiver. We also are analyzing new pathways for populations that aren't currently served by QHPs and developing equitable marketing so that all people in communities across the state, if this were rolled out, making sure that they have access to information available to apply for the program. The next proposal in the bill is implementation of federally funded healthcare for DACA recipients or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival. Earlier last year, the federal government came out with a proposed rule that said that that DACA recipients would be eligible for public healthcare programs. We are anticipating a final rule, which will make it final. And what this means for the state of Minnesota is that we currently have several state-funded only programs that serve these folks, and it would mean shifting them from a state-funded program to federally funded programs, which is a positive on the financial side of the state where we would then get a federal match for these folks. We also have some very interesting technical proposals in your bill. We have a comprehensive technical cleanup page with given the amount of language and investments you made last year, there's several items that just need technical updates, including fixing critical errors, carry forward amounts, effective dates, that kind of thing. That's a budget neutral proposal in your packet. Also on MMB's website, not in our change page document, the bill before you also reduces a contingent appropriation that the department got as part of the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, which did not pass. And the contingent appropriation said that if a similar bill were to pass, then DHS would have access to that funding in order to implement the bill. So this just repeals that contingent appropriation. I also wanted to point you to some key proposals in other areas in other jurisdictions because they really relate to the work that you do in this committee. While it's not in this bill, it is important for you to know the expansiveness of the DHS proposals elsewhere. We have a proposal in Chair Knorr's committee around expanding access to direct care and treatment with the focus of adding more beds and more capacity for the state to serve people who have mental health needs. We also have a proposal on that committee around acute care transitions. So similar thing where we're really trying to open up areas where the system may have blockages for people who have behavioral health needs. This proposal is centered around people who are stuck in hospitals. And how do we navigate that and deploy strategies to assist them in moving out quicker when they no longer need that level of care? That is in NOR's jurisdiction just because the solutions identified in that proposal are really centered around the long-term care waiver programs. We also have a proposal on reducing recidivism and implementing an 1115 waiver for people exiting corrections. In that waiver, we would be providing physical health services, mental health services, and SUD services. And then we have operational funding in Representative Pinto's committee related to the splitting off of children and families programs into their own Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And that was short and sweet. I have some links at in the back of your packet if you want to dig in further. I'll stand for questions at this time.
All right. Thank you. Let's do it this way. Let's have MDH come up and do their part of the presentation, and then we'll see if there's any testimony on the bill, and then we'll take questions. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
And I just do want to point out, like, in your packets, members, you have a printed copy of what was just shown on the screen, and there is also a printed copy of what Department of Health is about to show us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Good morning, everyone. Happy to be here again. For the record, I'm Brooke Cunningham, Commissioner of Health at the Minnesota Department of Health. Again, as you see that first slide, just to ground us, at the department, our mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. This is my first time before you this session, and I would be remiss if I didn't thank you all for all the investments that you made in public health last session. They were very important for us. Public health, as you know, has been through a sort of binge and then neglect sort of cycle. And so to be able to make some sustainable investments in public health so that we can continue our readiness to serve Minnesotans and to address new emergent needs has been really critical to us as a department. So just wanted to take one moment to really thank you all for those investments from last session. If you go to the next slide, in a policy year, we really have mostly a budget-neutral set of proposals here, except in the water space. As you all have been tracking, I'm sure, you know, drinking water is MDH's space, and water, safe, adequate drinking water for Minnesotans is important for public health. We are working with partners across the state, with PCA, with the Department of Ag, with federal partners, EPA, in terms of addressing water needs in our state. And particularly, we need to address the water challenges in Southeast Minnesota. Now, many people across Minnesota, about 20% of Minnesotans, live off private wells. There are not a lot of resources for those private individuals and families to address any potential contaminants in their water. This bill does that. And so it is the first phase of a multi-year investment in water, and particularly in addressing private wells in Southeast Minnesota, which, as the slide notes, will take up to 10 years. But we need to get started now, and we need some investments now. And so there's a bill here in the general fund which will cover mitigation options, so reverse osmosis, well repair, well replacement if necessary. There's also a proposal in the Clean Water Fund for a well inventory, for education and outreach, and for testing. And so that is our major budget ask for this session. We can go to the next slide. Otherwise, we have a number of technical fixes, but nonetheless important areas that we need this session. We've seen the rise in sort of mental health struggles, particularly among our young folk. So happy that we got the 988 line, mental health crisis line, in place last year. But we do need the legislature to set a fee for that line, and this proposal requests a fee of 12 cents to provide certainty to customers and providers, and to ensure that we have an adequate line for people to get their mental health needs, particularly when they're in crisis, met. We have a number of technical corrections that are also in the budget. It's really updated language to help MDH to implement programs as we have intended them to do. And again, they're budget neutral. And then MDH has moved sort of out of the background studies again. And so we get to give some money back to the SGSR. And this just really clarifies that licensees regulated by MDH are responsible for paying the fees associated with background studies, fingerprints, criminal record checks, consent form, and the criminal background check. Finally, we have a few other budget neutral items. In terms of financial exams, we know our insurance plans often have HMO and non-HMO products. They have to come under financial exams. We want to put some consistency there so that that happens every 5 years. We have a health professional clinical training expansion grant program. The way that program is written allows for a certain amount of money each year over the course of 3 years. This updates that program to give more flexible spending for grantees due to different funding needs during the years of training. And so, again, it's budget neutral, no additional money, but additional flexibility for our clinical partners and how they spend that money. Loan forgiveness, the same thing for individuals. It's budget neutral, but it creates a dedicated SGSR account for the MDH loan forgiveness program, allowing those funds to be reinvested in more awards to grantees instead of canceled. Again, this happens with timing as these awards go out, and so we'd like to correct that. And then we have some updates to supplemental nursing, which really clarifies the qualifications, training, and requirements for nurses and for nursing assistants to care for children, families, and other vulnerable individuals requiring these services. So things that are in place now, things that we look for, but really to clarify the language. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So is there anyone who wants to testify on this budget bill? Okay, not seeing anybody, so we can have some discussion on the budget. And, you know, before we do, I think it would be, just as a reminder, you know, this is the governor's budget. Certainly not everything in here is guaranteed to end up in the in this committee's omnibus bill. And, you know, lest we have a lot of discussion on it, I think I should just clearly state that it's not my intention to put the public option in the omnibus bill. So if members were going to, you know, have a big discussion about that, I would just say that that is not intended to go into the omnibus. It's not my intention, I should say, to put it in there. So Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I just ask a clarifying question on that then? Your intention to not include the public option stuff. Does that mean there is also not going to be instruction to seek the 1332 waiver? Is that your intention to not include that?
That is my intention, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. Then, Madam Chair.
New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only other question then, and perhaps this would be for you too, Madam Chair, because frankly you're the one who has to make the budget decisions. The telecom fee for 988. I'm sure it is no surprise that I would have significant concerns about raising another tax on Minnesotans. You know, again, last session, we already made life really difficult for Minnesotans and made it much more expensive for Minnesotans. We spent a $17.5 billion budget surplus, and you already increased taxes by $10 billion. Now, I would suggest that 988 probably falls under essential services. And the fact that we couldn't figure out how to pay for essential services with almost $30 billion is mind-blowing. And I hope that we will consider that as we move forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So, Representative New Brindley, that started out as a question to me. And I would just say that this is not raising a tax at all. It is just clarifying the current law allows the department by rulemaking, if they'll correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure, by rulemaking to pick an amount in a range that we gave them. And this says, rather than rulemaking, we're just going to pin it down on the lower end of that range. So, and I also just do want to say that I actually do agree with you, Representative New Brindley, about this particular thing, and I just lost the argument last year because I wanted us to actually appropriate money and pay for it rather than doing it this way. But I lost the argument, and the reason I lost the argument, I think, is that this is considered something that is so essential that people thought it needs its own kind of self-funding. And this is actually a national thing that's going on around the country, and this is the way that maybe not all states, but many states are doing it in this very way to have its kind of sustainable funding. But I'm with you on this should have been just funded. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate that because I agree with you, especially, I mean, we as a legislature should be focused on essential services, certainly first and foremost, and I think this falls in that. I would just add that, you know, they may be doing this around the country, but let's be clear, We are already taxed higher than almost any other state in the country at this point. We are taxed at the level of California and New York and New Jersey. So we are not, I mean, if there are 30 states doing this, we are not similarly situated as other states on that front. So I just hope that we keep those things in mind moving forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, this is not the tax committee, but let's go to Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we don't have time to go over the specific areas. There are many different places where we do not have the staffing to utilize the beds and facilities we have. And in the presentation where they're talking about expanding beds that overlaps into some of those areas, I think a priority should be put at actually staffing and getting and recruiting people, et cetera, above adding to the number of bed capacity that we can't fill. So that's just my personal suggestion to the chair as she goes through with the easy work of compiling her bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we ask, maybe you can tell me, I would like to have a little better understanding of the 2.8 million that in background studies that's being clawed back. I want to make sure that we're not putting that on our direct service providers. And I'm assuming that all of these providers are using NetStudy. I don't know that. And so that's the question I'd like to ask the commissioner.
Right. Well, okay. And I think that's kind of a partly a DHS and partly an MDH question. Right. But I would just say that, yes, this has been a little bit controversial. Representative Nadeau, you've probably heard from some providers that don't want to be paying this because in the past it's been paid for them. And I recognize they don't like it because they're being asked to pay for it, but everybody else who does a DHS study pays for it. So I think that this would be something that we could look at as it's been a little bit of a gift to them that it's been paid, but now we're not going to pay it for them any longer. So I recognize some people don't like it. You may hear a little bit about it, but this is the intention to go way to go forward on it. Do you feel like you need more than that?
No. Isn't it a subscription? And so there's been some providers that haven't had to buy into the subscription. Is that what you're saying? Because if that's it, then I totally agree with you.
Okay, I'm not really sure about that. I mean, is there staff that can kind of clarify that? Or who can help us here on this? Ms. Timian, thank you. Taking the hard questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lisa Timian, and I direct government relations at MDH. Representative Nadeau, to your question, my understanding is that how the NetStudy process works, it's not a subscription so much as it's a system that as applicants apply to it, it kind of pings it, and that was where it would trigger for MDH to be reimbursing for those. I think that's the simplest way. But it's not a subscription. It's like a per applicant basis that it's paid.
Okay. All right. And, Madam Chair, but it's an ongoing thing. I mean, it's always pinging.
Correct.
You know, so that's why I was under the impression that it was a subscription. It's not a one-time fee per employee. It's kind of I don't know exactly. That's why I was curious. If there's some people exempted, then by all means, I agree. But
okay, more answers.
Sorry.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and tell us who you are.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Ari Didion. I'm the acting legislative director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. When the fee is assessed when a provider submits, so basically when they have a new hire, they submit a study in the NS2 system, that's what the fee is for. So it's not like they're not getting more fees for that same employee, but as they're hiring new people, they would be paying that fee for each NS2 study that goes through.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Representative Nadeau, final question?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm very interested in the expanding access to DCT. And I think Representative Quam kind of hit on this, but you know, in here in three separate paragraphs, it talks about difficulty recruiting and training and retaining employees due to tight health care labor beds. I don't see anything in either of these proposals that deal with that challenge that is massive. And I'm wondering if somebody wants to talk more to that. It just seems like it's a glaring omission in the governor's budget that we're not focusing on making sure that the business models that we need to fund, that we need to have there, the beds that we need at Anoka and St. Peter and everywhere else. I'm really wondering why that's such a glaring omission. And if there's something that we could do.
Well, Representative Nadeau, this one really isn't in front of our committee. It was kind of presented as an informational thing here to let us know that it's happening. Okay. So I don't want to take time to dig into it in this committee. It's in front of Human Services. And so I think we're just going to leave it at that, and I would just suggest that you look into this more offline.
Okay. Thank you, Madam.
All right. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first, I wanted to say to the Department of Health and their proposal on the Loan Forgiveness Repayment Program, moving that to a special revenue fund, that's a great idea. I wish it would have come years ago, and I wish I would have had the idea, really. It's a good program, and I know many years we add to the list of people who qualify for it, but we don't add money to it, and so this is a way to get more people access to that. And overall, just trying to come up with the numbers on the FTEs, is there someone who could help me with the sum to make sure my counting is the same as what actually is the request for FTEs?
Representative Schumacher, which department are you talking to here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just overall between the two, just from what we've heard this morning. Understanding it wouldn't all fall into this committee, but just from both.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Welcome back. Okay. Please go ahead.
Chair, Representative Schumacher, I have a really rare answer for this. I don't think DHS has any FTEs in the jurisdiction of the proposals before you from DHS.
Okay. Representative Schumacher?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Perryman.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me. As we've heard in a couple of our committee about EMTs, is that representative into this budget, or where does EMT fall into when we start talking about the budget for as we move forward for EMTs?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Perryman. So there is a separate bill. As we heard bills in this committee, my understanding is that our bill will carry the EMT proposals and that the money will come with that. So there's a sort of a separate appropriation for that, but I my understanding right now is that we will be carrying that in our bill, but it's not in either of these two agencies, so it's not part of their budgets.
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. All right. Seeing no other discussion on the bill, this bill, House File 5317, is laid over for possible inclusion. So thank you, everyone. All right, Representative Herr, House File 4251. So Representative Herr is going to move that House File 4251 be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, there is an author's amendment.
Okay, and so Representative Herr is going to move the author's amendment to put it in the form in which she would like to have it discussed.
Pardon?
The A1 amendment. Yeah, the A1 amendment. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Herter, your bill has amended.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. I'm here to present House File 4251, which would prohibit sale of flavored cannabis products that are burned, inhaled, or vaporized. This bill does not address low-potency edibles or beverages that are already legally sold on the market. I think what's really important is this bill is really timely. There's been a lot of discussion around banning flavored cannabis and banning flavored tobacco. I think that it is really important for us to take this up and include it because these products are currently not sold right now in the market, and for us to be able to put parameters around it before it gets into the hands of children and young people, and that tactics that were used to increase tobacco use among our youth are able to be put into place. And so I ask for the committee support, and I do have testifiers here today who can talk to the bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Herr. So let's see. We have Colleen O'Neill. Welcome to the committee. Please
thank you.
Your name and go ahead.
Hello, Chair and committee members. My name is Colleen O'Neill. I am a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, often referred to as a chemical health specialist. I currently support the Mounds View School District, mainly the secondary schools. I am here today to fully support House File 4251. As a school-based chemical health specialist, I see firsthand the challenges our students are facing due to the changing landscape of both nicotine and cannabis vape devices. The vast majority of middle and high school students that I meet with use flavored vaping products, whether it's THC vapes, nicotine vapes, or both. In my district alone, I support over 80 students, and nearly all have reported that they use a flavored nicotine vape or cannabis vape. I have been fortunate enough to connect with over 20-plus school-based LADCs who do similar work as I. Together, we have created a sort of grassroots support group where we come together monthly and discuss those challenges we deal with in our schools. We all agree our biggest challenge to date is vaping nicotine and cannabis. Since last year alone, we have all seen an uptick in students vaping in our schools, and for many of us, more than half of those devices confiscated in the school setting are flavored cannabis vapes. Despite cannabis sales not being legal yet in our state, flavored cannabis vapes are available right now, and our schools are struggling with this. As a state, we need to get this right from the start by adding guardrails to keep these products from being so appealing to young people. You will see a small sample of products that have been confiscated in one middle school since last year, and a sample of various schools in my buildings since October. Again, I am one district out of the state. School administrators throughout Minnesota are stretched thin and challenged to meet the needs of our students on both an education and emotional level. My fellow school-based LADCs and I are doing everything we can to help students overcome immense challenges related to both nicotine and cannabis use. If we eliminate flavors, I firmly believe we will see fewer kids pick up a vape, and we would also see less mental health and substance use-related challenges in our buildings. This policy is too important to delay. We owe it to our kids. Please pass HF 4251. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Emily Myatt. And members, there are samples. These samples that she was mentioning are going around here, so please just take a look, and if you would pass them on. Representative Quammett sitting right next to you there. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, please don't eat them.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and committee members. My name is Emily Myatt. I am the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network and co-chair of Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation, a coalition of more than 50 organizations across the state that are sharing a common goal of advancing justice by striving towards a future where every person is free from commercial tobacco's harms. Commercial tobacco prevention and treatment advocates have worked for years, right, for years, to reduce youth tobacco use, help people quit, and address tobacco-related health disparities, and it's because of that work that we can support the bill before you today. We know how the tobacco industry has used flavored tobacco products to lure people into addiction. Menthol, fruit, candy flavors have propelled use with young people, with Black Minnesotans, American Indians, the LGBTQ plus community, and too many other groups. And we know that tobacco companies are investing heavily in the cannabis industry. This bill is about public health and health equity. While we support this bill, we know it's just one piece of a broader public health puzzle. We would urge the legislature to pass this bill and Representative Cha's bill to end the sale of flavored tobacco products. These bills prioritize public health, protect our kids, and advance health equity. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing any, we can have some discussion. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr. I feel like we've gotten a little bit of conflicting testimony, because on the one hand, we were told that this is not yet available, so we need to get ahead of this, right, and make sure it doesn't happen. And on the other hand, we were told that it's already happening. It's already in schools. So my question is, it is already illegal for people, for young people. These are supposedly not available at all yet. So what makes us think that we are going to stop it?
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, Representative Brindley, for that question. You're absolutely correct. These products are not available in Minnesota right now for sale. There are young people who are already obtaining them and not through legal methods or channels. And I think that for us to know that since our own cannabis laws and making it accessible to everyone, that these products will be coming on the market. And I think that the argument of that we shouldn't do anything, knowing that we already have a playbook from tobacco of what's going to happen, this problem will only get bigger if we don't then put parameters around the legal market. And so, like any bill that we pass, we never stop anybody from doing things that they shouldn't be doing. There's no one law that we have that actually catches everything and every person and every issue, and that we should not do something because we don't have something that is perfect in order to do that work. So I think it is really important for us to get ahead of this now.
All right. One follow-up, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say that I think that there is a lot of irony, particularly today, that we just had a discussion on pretty lengthy discussion on medical cannabis and how important it is and how it's going to make such a difference in people's lives. But now we want to take away the ability to maybe make it more palatable to people who some folks think it would really help. Frankly, I am not in that camp, but I mean, it's quite contradictory that on the one hand, we would say that here is this, you know, I mean, it's treated as this panacea that it's just going to help everyone and cure all that ails us. But we're also going to make sure that it's not more palatable to folks who a lot of people would say could really benefit from it and need it. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, this is more for the chair here. You know, this bill didn't meet deadline. I know we're laying it over. Is there a plan on how this will move forward, or was it your intentions just to kind of hear about it? I was wondering what your thoughts here, Madam Chair.
Well, the motion here, Representative Backer, is to have it laid over for possible inclusion. So this could be in our omnibus bill. And it did make deadline. I mean, in terms of, you know, it did make deadline for being included. So, Representative Backer, anything further?
All right. Yeah, because I understand, and I appreciate you answering that the bill did not meet deadline, because this is the first time we listened to it, unless it was overheard on the Senate. So I just...
Well, Representative Backer, I think you're misunderstanding the meaning of the deadlines and how they're applied under the rules. And I don't have that in front of me, but we could talk about that further offline if you like.
Sure.
Very brief closing, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and thank you, committee, for this. This bill had been heard in Commerce already as well, and I just want to be really clear that I sat here through that last hearing as well, and I don't think anybody claimed that the fixes to the medical cannabis was a panacea and would fix everybody's problems. The truth is that anybody claiming that is not being a good legislator, and I don't think anybody here would ever do that. This bill will not fix everything. This bill will not prevent children from getting access to this illegally, or adults, for that matter of fact, and that it is not going to actually do what my colleagues are thinking that we're expressing this will do. We're not claiming that at all. We think it is really important to protect children and youth. They are our first priority. We have seen what has happened to entire generations of individuals who were targeted by tobacco, especially the poor, the people of color, young people. And so I think it is really important. It is our responsibility to do something now to put those guardrails into place. So I ask for this committee support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Herr. With that, House File 4251 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. House File 4001, Representative Fisher, welcome to the committee. And Representative Fisher moves that House File 4001 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Fisher, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, committee. I'm here to present House File 4001,
This is a bill authorizing legislation to reallocate 26 long-term acute care hospital beds in Minnesota. This is beds that are current with Regency Hospital. This is to move the beds from Regency Hospital to Regents Hospital in St. Paul. Regency is in Golden Valley. This is not an expansion of beds, but just simply a relocation. The intent of the relocation is to provide better access for patients in Ramsey County who need long-term acute care hospital beds, as there is a substantial shortage. The arrangement can best be defined as moving hospital beds of one hospital into the location of another hospital. And Regents has been identified as the space that can accommodate these beds and will be built out over the course of the next 2 years. The Minnesota Department of Health has completed its public interest review on March 5th and has determined that the bed relocation is of public interest. One thing I would like to highlight that was in the report, just as future reference for this committee, is that when the Department of Health was looking at the proposals, and they noted that the proposals did not add capacity. It only made a request for modest change of reallocation of capacity in response to changing market conditions. And they were suggesting that the Minnesota legislature may wish to reconsider establishing a standing exception to law for some different items like this, instead of having to go through the entire review process to help take some of the burden off the department. So I do want to point that out. There were some recommendations of looking at that process. I do have one person who's here in case we have any questions, and at this point I'll open it up for the committee.
All right. Thank you, Representative Fisher. So let me just ask if there's anyone else who wants to testify on the bill. Okay, not seeing anyone, so we can open it up for any questions on the proposal. All right, I'm not seeing any, so very good. And just so members know, there's a copy of the public interest review in your packets as well. So with that, House File 4001 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Fisher. House File 5020 is also mine, and since I'm kind of not going to be, I don't know, do we have someone here who's going to present this for me, or is it just me? It's me. Well, then I'm going to go to the table and Representative. If you can. So, Mr. Chair, my motion would be that House File 5020 be laid over for possible inclusion, and I do have a DE 1-2 amendment that I would like to move.
All right, we can move the DE that the chair requests be moved. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, would you like to speak on the DE bill?
We've adopted the DE, right?
Sorry.
Okay.
The DE is adopted and approved. All right. Anything to speak on the DE now, or do you want to just go right to the bill?
Yeah. So I would like to speak just briefly to the bill as amended, okay. Mr. Chair. Okay. So the bill that is now before you, the DE that we adopted, let me just explain kind of what we're doing here. So we know that in Minnesota we do quite a bit of medical education, and medical education, when you listen to the teaching hospitals, is an expensive venture. It looks as though we're leaving a lot of federal dollars on the table that we're not pulling down for medical education that we could be pulling down. And so there's a consortium of teaching hospitals who are working on this bill. And if you are so adventurous as to try to read the bill, it is quite complex. And DHS has been working with this group to try to figure out how we can pull down these federal dollars. One of the things that we have to do in order to do that is have matching a non-federal share to match the federal dollars. And so this is a kind of an ongoing work to try to figure out how we can do this and get approval from the federal government to be able to pull down these additional dollars. So that's about as well as I can do kind of on my own with this. And
very
let's
good.
See, do we
Should
have
call
someone?
Call up the testifiers?
Yeah, I don't know if
we have
there's
two yes, listed
please,
here.
Great. And maybe Dr. they Frisch? Can do a better job at explaining this than I have done.
Well, Dr. Frisch, go first. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed, Dr. Frisch.
Mr. Chair and representatives, my name is Dr. Kelly Frisch. I am a primary care physician with 25 years experience in practice, and here today is the current board chair for the Metro Minnesota Council on Graduate Medical Education, or MMCGME. We're a coalition of teaching hospitals and graduate medical education programs, including Health Partners, Hennepin Health, M Health Fairview, the University of Minnesota, Allina Health System, Children's Minnesota, CentraCare, and Essentia. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 5020, which creates a new funding stream for graduate medical education, or GME. GME is required clinical training for physicians, which occurs after medical school, and is required to become a licensed physician and specialist. The training occurs within the clinical setting, or the hospitals and clinics, and residents and fellows are employees and are paid for their work. GME training includes residency and fellowship programs, which can range in from 1 year to 10 years in duration. Minnesota currently funds GME and training of essential non-physician health professionals through the Medical Education and Research Costs, or MERC program. MERC receives about $59 million per year in total funding from state and federal Medicaid reimbursement, funding that has been flat for nearly a decade. Committee members may recall hearing about MERC last session. Due to changing federal requirements, MMCGME worked with DHS, MDH, and the legislature to restructure this program. However, this was not increased funding for teaching hospitals. In fact, likely resulted in a decrease of state general fund compared to 2002 and previous years. Chair Liebling's bill, HF 5020, does not eliminate MERC. Rather, it leverages additional opportunities for federal matching funds to support GME. This means not only will GME see additional federal funding, but the current MERC funding stream will continue to support opportunities for many types of health professional training. I'm sure the committee members are well aware of the financial challenges for safety net hospitals, so I won't rehash these details. However, GME is yet another program that is paid well below cost. Teaching hospitals are often safety net hospitals, and we cannot make strides in addressing the physician shortage with current funding, and we cannot divert resources from patient care. We all share the goal of ensuring Minnesota remains a leader in medical education, innovation, research, and care. However, after decades of flat funding, we're falling behind. Other states spend 50 to 60% more per capita in support of Medicaid GME. For Minnesota, GME spending is $10.30 per person. Virginia, $16.50. Michigan, $16.20. Arizona, $15.80. New York spends nearly nine times more than Minnesota per capita, or $89.10 per person. Why does this matter? We know that well-trained physicians lead to high-quality outcomes. In 2022, Minnesota's teaching hospitals trained approximately 3,000 trainee physicians, and 72% stayed in the state for practice. Supporting GME training ensures our future workforce for the state of Minnesota. We need sustainable funding to support this work that does not draw from patient care resources to expand GME. GME is expensive. Costs of accreditation and salaries differentiate from other health professional education and training.
Dr. Frisch, we'll need you to wrap it up there, too.
GME requires a healthy infrastructure and resources, and I just wanted to refer to the Governor's Task Force on the University of Minnesota Academic Health endorsed this concept with 93% support to maximize Medicaid funding and to utilize the federal draw. Just wanted to comment, this distribution formula is supported by all Metro teaching hospitals, including CentraCare, Essentia Health, and Mayo Clinic. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Frisch. And thank you for being so available to have discussions. And I know you'll have discussions with any members of the committee if they have more questions directly. Thank you. Next up, Dr. Saltz.
Good
Please introduce yourself and you may proceed.
Mr. Chair and Representative, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF 5020. I'm Dr. Rachel Sauls, Chief Resident in Internal Medicine at Hennepin Healthcare. I'm originally from Roseville, a second generation U of M medical school and Hennepin trained physician. My mom completed her residency at HCMC in 1991. I care for patients hospitalized with acute illness and will continue my work in GME this summer as I join the hospitalist group at Regions. If you're worried about health equity, please invest in GME. When Medicaid pays for the full cost of training and residency, it best invests in health equity for the next generations. Among my colleagues, residents are increasingly culturally competent, language proficient, and diverse compared to the physician workforce which precedes us. Just last month, we welcomed an incoming class of bright and humanistic doctors who speak Spanish, Somali, Arabic, Portuguese, French, Hebrew, and more. They come from medical schools both blocks and continents away. If you're worried about the cost of healthcare, invest in GME. I spent 9 months of my two clinical years as a part of a rural program in western Minnesota and carry with me the stories of 10 older adults who partnered with local third graders in an intergenerational pen pal program. It was only through the knowing care of their primary provider was I able to recruit them for this experience. And finally, if you're worried about rural gaps in healthcare, please invest in GME. In our final months of training, my classmates and I celebrated the signing of our colleague. Born and raised in northern Minnesota and University of Minnesota Duluth graduate, he accepted a position as a full-time hospitalist in his hometown. And what spread faster than the news of his employment was the snapshot of the massive billboard posted outside the Rural Access Hospital, which welcomed him home. His community invested in him, and he now returns on that investment 100-fold. Thank you for allowing me to testify in this critically important legislation, and I'm happy to respond to your questions.
Thank you for the testimony. Would anyone else from the public like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Liebling, just to make sure I understand, I think just dumbing it down, the way I read this is that we are putting a small surcharge on the hospitals that will ultimately benefit from this. We are taking a small surcharge from them to then draw down additional federal funds so that ultimately they will be in better shape. I mean, is that basically what this is doing at a very elementary level?
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, that is absolutely, as I understand it, yes. And this bill has, you know, been worked on and figured out by them and how to do that and how to, so they are all in agreement on that. And the only real wild card here is whether the feds will approve that methodology. And we certainly hope they will.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is my question, is what happens if it's denied? Because, I mean, it looks like there's a contingent plan to develop a proposal if CMS denies this. My question is, and I apologize if I missed it in the language, my question is, I mean, it looks like this surcharge has to be paid immediately, like within 60 days after, is it enactment of the bill? Or is it federal approval? And I can just ask my second part of that question right now.
Please proceed.
Is that surcharge required to be paid when we get CMS approval? Or is it with 60 days after enactment of the bill? And if it is enactment of the bill rather than CMS approval, what's the contingency plan for what happens to that surcharge that has been paid?
Okay. Perhaps Representative New Brindley Research has this. Mr. John.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, the effective dates of this section make all of these sections contingent on each other. So the teaching hospital surcharge is tied to the supplemental payment rate, and if the federal government doesn't approve these sections, then the bill wouldn't go into effect.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chun. I don't see any other members for questions, so final word.
Thank you, committee members, and thank you for having eyes on this, Representative New Brindley. I mean, this is really complicated, and just to say that I think it's a bit of a work in progress, and the language could possibly change, you know, as they continue to work on this between now and the omnibus bill. But the intention is exactly as you stated, and if we can, You know, one of the things we do in Minnesota is we try not to leave federal money on the table when we need it for important things here in the state. So that's what this is attempting to do.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. With that, the bill is amended as laid over as amended. And that will be take care of that. And then the next meeting will be April 12th, 9 a.m. Friday. So, and with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, members.